How should Lutherans respond to the assertion, your church is too Catholic? Find out in Pastor Will Wheaton's column in the latest Issues Etc. Journal. We'll send it to you for free. Just click the red journal subscription button in the right-hand column at issuesetc.org. In the Wittenberg Trail feature, Joshua Pauling traces his path from big box evangelicalism and Reformed Calvinism to the treasures of historic Christianity found in the Lutheran Church, the free online Issues Etc. Journal.
What's called woke culture and what's called innocent signaling, it's actually virtue signaling. There's an attempt to show the world that I'm pure.
Social justice is not compatible with a biblical commitment. CRT, critical race theory, is not compatible with a biblical commitment at all. And neither is liberation theology.
And Jesus invites us, come on and be Lazarus now. Don't worry about it. I've got the end covered. You need to worry about not being the rich man now. And remember, the mark of the rich man was he despised the words. He would not listen to them.
Topics you can really sink your teeth into. That's why Iowa dentists love Issues Etc.
The church has always had its liturgy. Yes, it has changed in forms, sometimes in content, but part of the reason that the church has its liturgy is because as human beings, we are liturgical beings. Tradition, gesture, movement, symbol, even the way that we keep time. Well, it's all kind of a liturgy, including one of our big sources of entertainment, sports, full of tradition, ritual, even the way we keep time. Greetings and welcome to Issues Etc. on this Friday afternoon, March the 26th. I'm Todd Wilkin. Thanks for tuning us in. In the first hour of this program, we're going to be talking about the traditions and the rituals of sports and the church. Josh Pauling will join us. A little bit later, the book of Proverbs. Today, Proverbs 20 with Pastor Jonathan Fisk of The Mad Christian. Then an hour from now, an encore interview with historian Dr. Paul Meyer on the events of Holy Week. Joining us to discuss the traditions and rituals of sports and the church, Josh Pauling. He's a high school English teacher, head elder at All Saints Lutheran Church in Charlotte, North Carolina, and author of a two-part column for Modern Reformation titled The Liturgy of Sport and Lessons for the Church. Josh, welcome back.
Great to be with you again, Todd.
You say that sports are a window into how human beings come to adore something. What do you mean by that?
So take a moment and think about the levels of commitment and passion that sports produce for many people. Whether it's that middle-aged diehard fan who dresses up in full costume with body paint to attend the NFL game, sort of like a warrior going into battle, or, you know, even the hours of time we devote to practicing sports or improving our chances of making the team or getting a scholarship, the time spent watching sports or the money spent on buying sports gear or clothing, all of these things reveal the central role of sports in our lives. And, you know, right now during March Madness, it's a good time to sort of reflect on those things. It's on full display. So this is not a sports are bad argument. It's not the argument I'm trying to make in the column. I was a multi-sport athlete in high school and played a bit in college and coached high school baseball and cross country in the past. And I enjoy playing sports, as many of us do, and watching sports. They can be great tools to stay healthy and build friendship and work ethic, etc. But instead, the goal here is to reflect on how sports tap into elements of the human psyche in ways that produce such high levels of commitment and devotion in the first place, right? So the point I'm trying to make isn't that many people are devoted to sports. That's pretty obvious. Instead, what I'm trying to explore is how sports can teach us how devotion and commitment are formed in human beings. What is it about sports rituals and practices, what we might even call liturgies, that make them so powerful? And how can the church recapture these things to help rightly order our loves and intentionally form a liturgical life structured around the word and sacrament? Because that's really what plants Christianity deep into the blood, much like sports have done for many people.
We're going to be using, we have used this word liturgy. How are we going to be using that word?
Yeah, that's a great question, Todd. So let's clarify this here. There's a few different ways we could use liturgy. One sense of liturgy, the word liturgy we would find in the New Testament, in the Greek, liturgia, which means public offices fulfilled at one's own cost. So for example, in New Testament times, this would be like say, an act of public service done by a patron or a benefactor for the good of the community. the work of a greater person for the good of the lesser, right? The benefactor who takes care of the community through acts of service or something like that. And we see this come down to us. The Lutheran reformers really captured this meaning well in the German with Gottesdienst, right? God's service, which then comes down to us in English as the divine service. And this is so rich and vital to our understanding of what happens in the divine service and who the ultimate actor is in worship, right? That's God. God's the greater being who's acting in worship to deliver his objective gifts to us, the lesser beings. It's not the other way around, right? Liturgy isn't our work, it's God's work. So that's, you know, the specific sense of liturgy as divine service that Lutheranism historically has understood so beautifully. But then there's also the broader concept or more generic concept of liturgy as being an order or structure, a series of rituals or routines that form the outline of any event or activity. And that's the sense I'm using it in my piece. And the author, James K. Smith, in his wonderful book, Desiring the Kingdom, puts it this way, quote, "Liturgies are rituals of ultimate concern, rituals that are formative for identity and that inculcate particular visions of the good life." So in the broader sense of the word, much of life has a liturgical nature to it, many times without us even thinking about it or knowing it. And that's why it's important to take a step back and think about how rituals and practices and habits are forming us and whether or not they're forming us towards the proper ends of Christ and his kingdom.
You have identified what we might call the Holy Trinity of sports. What is it?
Right. So I tried to come up with a catchy way to capture the nature of sports in our culture and came up with a trinity of sorts. For sure, there are more things we could add and some might quibble with my choices. And again, I'm not making a sports or bad argument here. I'm just trying to think and reflect on these things to learn from them. So the trinity of sports I suggest is consumerism, competition, and entertainment.
Give us some examples of sports and those things, consumerism, competition, and entertainment.
Sure. So consumerism, this would include everything from all the gear that's marketed to fans, fantasy sports, online gambling. Sports are indeed big business. We could also look at the fact that in nearly all of the 50 states, a college coach is the highest paid public employee. Or the astounding fact that kids' sports are now a $20 billion industry, especially thanks to the rise of elite travel sports, which gets very expensive, as many parents could attest to. According to Derek Thompson at The Atlantic, kids' sports are now larger than the business of professional sports and approximately the same size as that of the NFL. As far as competition goes, sports become another mythic avenue towards fulfilling the American dream, almost another platform for the bootstrapping competition paradigm to play out. And we see sometimes the extremes of this with performance-enhancing substances and extreme competition to market oneself to get college scholarships and so forth. And again, competition can be a very healthy thing. You know, there's something to be celebrated about excellence, whether it's, you know, hitting the target with a bow and arrow or, you know, shooting the three-point shot or whatever it might be. Excellence is to be celebrated, and athletic excellence is part of that. But sometimes it can also get off the rails a little bit. And then finally, sports, as far as entertainment goes, it's indeed a massive enterprise. All the sports channels and radio stations, websites, blogs, podcasts, on and on we could go. There's way more sports entertainment available than there are hours in the day. And also there's a growing blend of theater and sport that we see more and more with ubiquitous touchdown celebrations and the signature camera poses. All of those things are further evidence of sports as entertainment. Pre-game rituals with the mascots that are costumed and the females that are costumed less, and the fireworks and all the rest, it's really a show, right? And again, entertainment's not bad. They're necessary components to human experience. But sometimes this trinity of sorts can distract us from ever using our leisure time for serious reflection or grander pursuits of real worth.
The church year and the liturgical calendar are the church's way of marking time. Is there a parallel in sports?
Oh, absolutely, Todd, yes. Think of where we are right now in the calendar, right, with March. Well, as this time of year rolls around each year, most folks know what's coming, and it probably isn't Lent, Holy Week, and Easter, right? It's March Madness. And again, I enjoy March Madness. Many of us do. There's nothing wrong with that. Think of it from this perspective as far as, like, what is happening during March Madness culturally. Right? The forces of culture roll out the same music, the same rituals, the same routines. And yet again, people participate with excitement and intensity, right? And you'll have to excuse me, but, you know, if I hum da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da, right, immediately what comes to mind? Well, that's the open theme to CBS March Madness. We could do that with the Masters and the songs they use, or the Super Bowl, or whatever the event is. There's all of these things that we participate in, right? And usually when those things come up again the following year, nobody really says, oh man, we got to do that again. No, it's excitement again, right? Everybody's excited for this yearly rhythm to life. And, you know, the church has, as you said, this great gift to tap into as well. The church year, the liturgical year, the lectionary, all of those things orient Christians to the sacred time of the eternal kingdom, which can help break the bonds that might tether us to the consuming secular sporting calendar.
So talk about the rituals of sports.
So if we think about a sporting event from beginning to end, whether in person we're participating or on the screen we're watching, there's clearly a liturgy, an ordered structure to the event that's filled with rite and ceremony. It's part of what makes sports meaningful, right, and memorable. Take, for example, like, let's say, a pregame ritual for a college football game, right? So each team parades onto the field with a mascot and flags and countless fans cheering. There's a American flag prominently located, and everybody rises for the national anthem. There's team captains in the middle of the field for a coin toss with easily identified uniformed referees. Then there's the kickoff, right, with everybody chanting and participating, sometimes even wearing the same color shirts at the famous Penn State whiteouts or whatever your team is. And when we experience those things or observe those things, we don't say, oh, that's a meaningless ritual. We have quite a different response. And again, to get back to James Smith's book, Desiring the Kingdom, he says that, you know, that this constitutes a liturgy because it's a material ritual of ultimate concern. Through a multisensory display, the ritual both powerfully and subtly moves us, and in so doing, implants within us a certain reverence and awe. Right? And I think that's a good way of capturing what happens at a sporting event. And the church, you know, we have the same types of things to tap into. If we apply the pregame ritual to the church, for one, you know, as the church, we should display and parade what holds redemptive value. Christ on the cross, the Holy Gospel processed and followed by a minister who is recognizable because he wears a uniform, much like the referees at a football game, right? A clerical collar covered by vestments. But instead, if we think about many churches in America, the only thing that might be paraded through the aisles might be a tray filled with money, not a cross or a Bible, or heaven forbid, the elements of Holy Communion. Probably the only thing that gets consistently paraded through many church aisles is cash, right? So think, what does that communicate, right, when we do such things? Everything we do speaks, right, and communicates a message. The question we need to think about is what is it communicating?
Josh Pauling is our guest on this Friday afternoon, March the 26th. We're talking about the traditions and rituals of sports and the church. He's author of a two-part column for Modern Reformation titled The Liturgy of Sport and Lessons for the Church. We'll be right back.
St. Paul says in Ephesians chapter 2 that the Gentiles are without God in the world and without hope.
Pastor Brian Wolfmiller talking about his presentation at the 2021 Issues Etc. Making the Case Conference.
Now that's an amazing statement. It means that to be without God is to be without hope, and the corollary, to be with God is to have hope. Christians are marked by this. We have hope. And we have hope not only in this life, but we have hope in the life to come. Our Christian hope expands past death, past the last day, even to the resurrection of the body, the new heaven and the new earth where the righteous dwell. We have this extended horizon of hope, and we dwell under that cloud of glory.
You can meet and hear Pastor Wolfmiller making the case for Christian hope at this year's Making the Case Conference, Friday, July 23rd and Saturday, July 24th at Concordia University, Chicago. Find out more and register at IssuesETC.org.
Old theology, new technology. You're listening to Issues Etc.
When I Listen to the best of the church's music for the season of Lent at LutheranPublicRadio.org. Sacred music for the season of Lent, LutheranPublicRadio.org.
Welcome back to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. We're talking about the traditions and rituals of sports and the church. Josh Pauling is our guest. You can read about Josh's journey from American Evangelicalism and Reformed Calvinism to Confessional Lutheranism in the latest Issues Etc. journal. It's online and it's free. Go to our website, issuesetc.org. Find that red subscription button on the right-hand side of the page. Click on that and enter your email address, and then we'll send you the journal. Josh, why does sports fandom distinguish between what we could call the novice fan, the casual fan, and the initiated fan?
Right. So it's really because sports have to maintain a certain standard and consistency to sustain themselves over time, right? They can't constantly be changing the rules to appeal to new fans. There wouldn't be any continuity then that made the sport meaningful over a span of time. So in general, if you think about it, sports don't really change to accommodate the greenhorn fan. Instead, the beginner digs deeper to fully participate. Right? Like if, for example, we think about how we teach our kids about sports, right? For example, I really enjoyed baseball. I played baseball in high school and for a short time in college for one semester. I didn't play longer than that. So baseball is sort of my thing. And I know we've got some St. Louis Cardinals fans in the studio there, so yay for that. So if you think about Major League Baseball and our children, when we're teaching our kids about the game, it's a very incremental process of absorption about the rules and norms of the game until it sort of becomes habituated or instantiated as part of our lives. As initiated fans, we don't sort of request that Major League Baseball change the rules to appeal to our children or to appeal to new fans. Instead, we bring them in, right? We teach them. As the game is going on, again, whether it's baseball or football, whatever your sport is, we teach all the ins and outs as the game is going on. And the process takes a while, right? Think about many Americans' response to watching a rugby game, right? We have no idea of what's going on because we're not formed in that sport, right? We haven't absorbed the rules and norms of the game over years of observation and habituation. And so there's a sense of intrigue around a sport that is there, almost a barrier to entry that sort of draws people deeper into the sport and learning the rules and stories that accompany it. That's part of the reason that it sustains itself over time.
Can the church learn something from this rigorous initiation?
Oh, for sure. Definitely. We should keep this in mind, right? Just as sports don't change the rules to appeal to new people, we should consider that when dealing with newcomers as well. And if we think back to the early church, very quickly, within the first century even, there was a lengthy process of catechesis for converts that was developed that culminated in baptism on Easter, the day of the resurrection, which is fitting to think about in this time of year. Now, I'm not suggesting that we develop some legalistic requirement for church membership or anything like that. But what I do think we need to consider is that in our contemporary concern to bring people in, many church bodies have sort of changed the rules, you might say, and modified the process of Christian initiation to make it quick and painless and void of any meaningful content. And in the long run, I really think this proves counterproductive, as it fosters either sort of a shallow Christianity or a consumerist mindset in the church where you can sort of pick and choose what you want, right? And so as the church, we need to remember not to lose our true identity in attempts to accommodate the culture. That just like the sports fan who instructs and enables the uninitiated to eventually embrace the sport by a process of teaching and almost catechesis, you could say, the church needs to be proud of who she is, right? Explain her theology, her rites, her rituals, not get rid of them. If sports are willing to do that, why should it be any different in the church, where we have something even better to offer than any short-lived sporting glory?
Sports are obviously soaked in tradition and in heritage. You might even say that without those, they wouldn't be very interesting. What does that tell us about the importance of these things, tradition and heritage, in the church?
Right, exactly. Yeah. So again, let's think about March Madness, right? every year we see the old footage of Michael Jordan in Tar Heel white and blue nailing that jump shot from the early 1980s. We see Jimmy V running down the court when NC State won. We see all that footage, and it brings us back into the story, right? And so that's a big part of the culture of sport, is the story and the tradition and the heritage. Think of all the records tediously kept, right? Especially in professional sports, every statistical category imaginable. And now with all these new metrics and technologies, we can even create new statistical categories that are seemingly never ending. Think of also the fact that each team has its mythic heroes, its legendary tales. And these stories function really very much like ancient myths and folk tales. They forge a sense of group identity. They almost provide an origin myth for the team and its fans. And strong bonds are formed around such shared history. It provides a narrative, a sense of meaning, right? And that's something we all long for, a story to be a part of. Sports teams and leagues also celebrate anniversaries, and they build shrines to star athletes. They don't distance themselves from the past by arguing times have changed. They really receive the past as a gift that gives meaning to the present. And similarly, the church, right? We have the ultimate story, the true narrative of redemptive history that comes complete with records tediously kept in the scriptures, an origin story in Genesis. And then even better than a team identity, we have the universal identity found in Christ, the true hero, the God-man. Indeed, the myth made fact, the real historical story of unsurpassed artistry and truth that speaks to our universal experience of fallenness and the common desire for forgiveness. And that's all embodied in Jesus Christ, right? The one who has taken on flesh to overcome death and reverse the fall. And that's such a beautiful story that we have. And if sports fans embrace their history and traditions with joy and gratitude, the church also needs to do that even to the nth degree, because we actually have an inheritance of lasting meaning for the life of the world.
How do you explain the fact that many Christians love and embrace and value the traditions and rituals associated with sports, something as it's a game, or politics, which is also transitory, but are wary of traditions in the church?
Excellent question. Excellent point. Yeah, it's very true. It's sort of interesting, isn't it? I think there'd be several things here. First, in general, there's a skepticism of authority and external structures in our society today, especially in relation to religion. So what is seen as good and true are things internal to the self, right? Buzzwords like authenticity or lived experience or living your truth or spontaneity, transparency even, or dead religion, or somebody who says they're spiritual but not religious. All of those things that tend to be valued in society, those are the things that come to mind, right? Transparency, authenticity, etc. So when a church or religion attempts to have its members participate and abide by an external ordering or structure that's beyond the self, well, many view that as oppressive or limiting in the realm of religion. I think secondly, though, too, many are wary of traditions in the church in our American context because of the history of religion in America. If you think about the colonial era and the Puritans and Pilgrims and many of the colonists who came from European nations, they're very skeptical of rituals and of ceremonies and of external religion, right? They were fleeing from persecution from the Catholic Church, or they were wanting to purify the Anglican Church, or they were very skeptical of those external structures and rites of religion. So that's part of the background in the American context. And then too, in America, with the First and Second Great Awakening, religion was very much becoming an internal subjective thing. And then more recently, we'd also see language of religion as a matter of the heart, right? Asking Jesus into my heart, my personal testimony. So a lot of it is internally driven, emotionally driven, not externally by tradition or rituals or rites. Another way to think about this question might be to broadly think about two general ways that people approach religion. In one sense, some people approach religion as a matter of cognitive agreement or mental assent to a certain set of teachings or theological propositions, right? But then also some people, the other perspective would be that religion is a matter of emotional feeling or internal subjective experience that can't be measured by rationality or propositional statements. Right. But both of those ways of thinking are really incomplete. We're not just thinking things that can sort of abstractly achieve status with God, but neither are we just emotional things emoting our way to God. And so both of those really miss out on the role of tradition and external things, rites, rituals, etc., in forming one's religious life. And so I think here, James K. Smith, again, is very helpful, where he says that that we are embodied beings of desire and love, right? Yes, we have brains, but we also have hearts. And the key is to combine those things together. And that's what the rites and rituals and traditions of the church do. They help us have rightly ordered loves and desires and emotions in accord with biblical theology.
So in summary, what does the cult of sports, for lack of a better term, tell us about humanity?
I think it really tells us that we as human beings are going to find things to worship. By nature, we are desiring creatures. And sports provide us with many things that fulfill those desires. I think on this point, John Calvin was right, that the human heart is a perpetual factory of idols. But again, at a deeper level here, the goal isn't to just simply say that sports can become an idol or sort of a religious thing. The point here is to think about what makes sports so powerful and how it is that humans come to adore something to begin with. And that's, I think, where the church can learn some lessons from the sports world and lessons that we used to know and leverage very consistently in church practice. But we've sort of forgot those things as we've moved more towards a sort of a authenticity mindset in the church or a transparent mindset in the church, spontaneity, relevance, all of those words that are so popular in Christianity at large. All of those things really jettison the traditions, the rituals, and the rites. But the funny thing is they really replace all those rituals and rites just with new ones, right? There's no such thing as non-liturgical worship. Every worship service has an order or a structure to it. The question really is, what structure is most faithful to the scriptures? And which is most consistent, right? Which practices are most consistent with the doctrines of Christianity? And that is where, again, the church historically has really grasped this. The ancient church's maxim, lex orandi, lex credendi, right? The law of what is prayed is the law of what is believed. And that's a very powerful thing to keep in mind here, right? That how we pray or worship, you might even say, is many times going to influence how we believe, right? And again, with James Smith's insights in mind, we might twist the phrase around a little bit just to capture with a more contemporary punch and maybe say something like, how you worship is how you end up believing. Or maybe even we might turn around an old phrase. We've all heard, practice what you preach. But maybe it'd be more helpful to think about as well that your practice preaches, right? Perhaps actually our practices preach more than we realize. Perhaps our practices even preach more than our preachers. And by that I mean that the practices we're involved in as Christians, right? Our habits, the things that form us, might even be more powerful than the words we say, right? And that's what really is important to remember. Christianity must be more than just an intellectual worldview. It also must be more than just an emotional feeling. The best chance we have for Christian perseverance is when Christianity is implanted into the deepest parts of our being and constitutes the central rhythms of our experience. There's got to be a resonance to doctrine and practice. And Lutheranism captures that so beautifully in the Divine Service. And again, the church used to know these things and harness them, and we really need to recapture those things in ways that will give us the best chance of passing down this inheritance to the next generation.
Josh Pauling is a high school English teacher, head elder at All Saints Lutheran Church in Charlotte, North Carolina, and author of a two-part column for Modern Reformation titled The Liturgy of Sport and Lessons for the Church. You can read it at our website, issuesetc.org. Click Talk On Demand Archives. Josh, thank you very much.
Thanks, Todd.
When we come back, we're going to pick up our series on the Book of Proverbs with Pastor Jonathan Fisk of The Mad Christian. We'll be taking up some selected verses of Proverbs chapter 20.
I'm Chaplain Sean Denzer, Director of Worship for the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod. Congregations work hard to keep the Word of Christ dwelling richly in His disciples now and into eternal life. We work to help and support that effort. Learn more at lcms.org/worship. You'll find resources on the church year, Bible studies on the hymns of the day, audio helps for learning to sing our services, and look for worship planning resources to find the latest from LCMS worship. That's lcms.org/worship. May the word of Christ dwell richly in you.
In the midst of life's struggles and trials, we are tempted to find comfort in something other than the Word of God, to find comfort in something other than where God has promised to be and what He has promised about us. Oftentimes, we find this comfort, knowingly or unknowingly, in superstitions, in the various superstitions that surround us. Read the March issue of the Lutheran Witness to find out more about superstitions and their place in the Christian life. We talk about superstition, scientism, and so much more. Visit cph.org/witness to order your copy today. The Lutheran Witness, helping you look at the world from a Lutheran perspective.
Sacramental, historical, liturgical. You're listening to Issues, Etc.
Remember when education was about the fundamental skills of reading, writing, and arithmetic? And about reading great literature and studying history to give our kids a model for what it is to be a good person? Memoria Press's classical Christian curriculum offers that very model for your homeschool. Get $5 off your next order by using the coupon code LPR21. For more information, go to memoriapress.com. Memoria Press, saving Western civilization one student at a time.
Are you planning your vacation in the Orlando area? Are you thinking about retiring in Central Florida? Are you looking for a faithful Lutheran church near the theme parks? Then Zion Lutheran Church and School is the place for you. We're in Winter Garden, Florida, about 20 minutes from all the attractions. At Zion Lutheran Church and School, we believe, teach, and confess God's truth for you. Find out more on our website, zionwg.org.